connected. And I think we can say good morning, honorable members, the DTIC Commission Tribunal. And I think we do actually have a roll call for members. Andre, if you can just try and check. I was thinking it will actually be helpful just to see the face of a member when we say present or in the session. Secretary, can we actually then try and do that?
No problem, Chair. Ms. Mwasi, Chair.
Honorable Mwasi. Honorable Mwase.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everyone. Present, Chairperson.
Welcome, welcome. Thank you very much. Can you take the next member?
Mrs. Hermans, Chair.
Honorable Hermans.
Chair. Present.
Okay, let's see. Let's see, Hermans.
Mr. Tring, Chair.
Okay, Honorable Tring.
Present, Chair. Good morning, all.
Morning, morning.
Chair, Mantashe, Chair.
Honorable Mantashe.
Morning, Chairperson, and good morning to everyone.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can we take a welcome, Mantashe? Next.
Chair, Mr. Mulder, Chair.
Honorable Mulder.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning to all.
Morning, 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 Honorable Mulder. Thank
Chair,
you, Secretary. Yeah.
Ms. Mutahum, Chair.
Honorable Mutahum.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to everyone.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mutahum. Next member.
Chair, we have Mr. Cuthbert struggling to connect, but we'll address that, Chair, as well. Chair, then we have also apologies, Chair, if you want me to do that, or do we look at the agenda first when we do look at apologies, Chair?
Yeah, I think obviously let's see who's connected, and then I think for apologies we can be able to have that as the next part, because I think we just have to determine our quorum so that we can be able to continue in a representative form. And the apologies side,
if I may, Chair, we can. The apologies, Chair, is that Mr. Mumuyani will be joining the committee late, Chair. He's just attending to a family matter, Chair. Then Ms. Yaku will not be attending today. She's attending, I think, the Justice Committee meeting, as well as the alternate for the Freedom, Gram Freedom Front, the EFF, Chair.
Yeah.
So, and I think Mr. McPherson, our author, is probably struggling, Chair, so we'll try to make sure they are connected. But we can proceed. We have a quorum, Chair, and we can proceed with the meeting, Chair.
So I'm sure the members will be actually in agreement that we proceed. So obviously, I think we should be able to look at the agenda. Secretary, if ever can actually fly that, because we are representative.
Yeah, Chair, Mr. Cuthbert has joined us, Chair.
Okay. Welcome, Cuthbert. Let's actually check on the agenda. We're looking at the adoption. The areas which are covered from now is the update on the implementation of the new legislation. And there's also the issue of the briefing of the Competition Commission Tribunal and the issues relating to investigation and cases. So I think there is actually a part where we actually were hoping that we will be taking comments, questions for clarity, which is actually an item just before concluding remarks. So if I can actually just make that addition, that we'll have the presentation, there will be actually members' comments, questions, and engagement, which is actually immediately after that, and then we will conclude the meeting. So it's an area between the conclusion and the presentation, the briefing. Okay. So can we actually just make that as amendment or acknowledge that amendment, Secretariat? Can I put the agenda before the committee? let's hear if ever the committee is comfortable for us to proceed in the order of the agenda. Honourable members.
Chairperson.
Yeah.
I move adoption of the agenda.
Thank you, Honourable Mwase. Move for adoption. Muntashe.
I propose that we second the adoption of this agenda.
Thank you, Muntashe. Can I just check if ever there's any objection? And if not, can I then actually, I know, Secretary, that we do have the DTIC team. If ever we can actually just get the representative who's present. Secretariat?
Chair, I think Dr. Pule will lead a delegation, Chair, and he will be able to indicate who is all present, Chair.
Good morning, Doctor. Welcome. Can I ask that you just give a brief introduction of your team and then actually take us through the presentation? Welcome, Doctor, and the delegation. Dr. Pule.
Thank you, Chairperson, and morning to Chairperson and the members of the Portfolio Committee. I'm here on behalf of the DG and the DTIC. In the delegation this morning, Chairperson, is the Commissioner of the Competition Commission, Dr. Thembi Nkosibona Kelezia, as well as his Deputy Commissioner, Hadin Ratshutshu, I see. The Chief Legal Counsel from the Competition Commission as well, Dr. Baki, is also here. Also joining us, Chair, is the Chairperson of the Competition Tribunal, Memondo Mazwai. So I will start with the presentation, just giving an overview of where we are in terms of the implementation of the Competition Amendment Act from the perspective of the department, followed by the Commissioner, Ntate Bonakele, who will go into a bit more detail in the provisions of the Act from the perspective of the Competition Commission. And then finally, and he will also then touch on, with your indulgence and guidance, Chair, your guide, but he's also ready with the presentation in terms of the data of the implementation of the COVID interventions that were done. And the Chairperson of the Competition Tribunal, similarly, Chair, has got a presentation that covers both areas. So the Amendment Act as well as the COVID update, Chair. With your indulgence, Chair, I will then proceed to share my screen, start the presentation, and then following on to my presentation, I propose that the Commissioner proceeds and then the Tribunal, and then with the indulgence of the Chair, we will then be open for questions and matters of clarity. With your indulgence, Chair?
Yeah, I think we will do that, Doc. Take all the presentations and then get to that point as you suggest. The floor is yours, Doctor, if you can actually proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I trust that Chair can see the presentation.
Very well, very well.
Thank you. I want to see if I need to video for myself, just so that the network is not clean. Thank you, Chair. This presentation that I'll give now, Chair, is a brief overview of the some of the highlights that will give the Portfolio Committee an indication in terms of where we are in implementing the provisions of the Competition Amendment Act. Various sections of the presentation cover different aspects. We'll just start with a quick sense of background and then get into some highlights in terms of the provisions of the Amendment Act and where we are in implementing them. And finally, close off with elements relating to institutional readiness of the competition authorities towards implementing these Amendment Acts. Now, there is likely, possibly, Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee to be some overlaps, as my presentation will just give a broad overview and a broad sense. The detail in terms of what the Competition Commission will say will obviously touch on some of the issues that I would have already just given an indication on. So please indulge us if there are any overlaps in terms of the presentations, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. Now, we are aware, Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, where the history comes from. It's very well explained in the presentations that will come later, in the latter part of this meeting. However, we know that this is this was on the back of significant work that was done in government, significant work that was done by Parliament, based on the issue of ensuring that we open up the economy, deconcentrate the economy, and ensure that there are greater levels of economic participation. Emphasis is obviously given, as well as members of the PC, to specific sectors of the community which need to be supported to participate in the economy more efficiently: SMMEs, black-owned businesses, and public interest considerations are a big part of the work that is looked at in terms of the Competition Amendment Act. Now, the benefits of the Amendment Act, again, as a refresher, Chair, this is information that members of the Portfolio Committee are very well aware of. However, just as a refresher, some of the benefits of the Competition Amendment Act, Chair, relate to clarifying and broadening the mandate of the competition authorities in order to equip them to more efficiently, more effectively address economic concentration, provide greater clarity to role players in the economy, as well as enhancing some administrative efficiencies in the work of the authorities. It also gives the executive authority some enhanced participation powers in terms of measure proceedings and other aspects within the Act. Now, as I said, Chair, members of the PC, we are well aware that this is a process that took a number of years to get through. It involved everything from the beginning of the State of the Nation address announcement right through to consultations with various stakeholders through the breadth of the country in terms of various stakeholders involved in the economy, and culminating in the President signing the Competition Amendment Act into law February 2019. So that's a significant process that we know. Some of the highlights which I emphasize in this presentation, which, as I said, Chair, will be also detailed and gone into further by the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal, relate to the buyer power and price discrimination, so abuse of dominance provisions and regulations that were implemented. Section 1010, COVID block exemptions, which assisted government to react swiftly and react and demonstrate an agile ability in reacting to the COVID pandemic, and which worked, the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal worked with the National Consumer Commission and led with some measure of extension, really. I mean, they've reported on that significantly, and today they also present further updates to the Portfolio Committee as well as members of the public. There are also provisions, the key provision of the Competition Amendment Act, Chair, relates to Section 18A, which is in relation to foreign acquiring firms and merger acquisitions. So that is a key provision which is also to be implemented, the final touch-ups, as well as work that is being done now in terms of ensuring that the competition authorities continuously adjust on the back of the Amendment Act, but also on the back of other imperatives, continuously adjust to be efficient and effective and ready to fulfill their mandate. So this presentation will essentially highlight those aspects. There's more, as you'll see in the other presentation, but those are the aspects that will be highlighted here. In terms of the abuse of dominance provisions, the buyer power regulations are one which are important, and the minister subsequently gazetted buyer power regulations relating to that, which aim really to support fair participation for small, medium, and enterprises, as well as firms owned by historically disadvantaged persons, which protects them from powerful players in the economy from unfairly suppressing prices or imposing certain conditions to exclude them from participating efficiently. The Commission issued guidelines on that relating to those buyer power regulations, Chair. As we know, Chair, the Minister will issue regulations. The Commission is empowered by the Act to issue guidelines. So those guidelines were subsequently issued and published on the website of the Competition Commission. Similarly, Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, price discrimination regulations were also gazetted by the Minister, also aiming really to support your SMMEs and HDP firms in the economy. These are critical aspects of the Amendment Act, which I highlight here, Chair. As we know that really it's important that we give as much support as possible towards ensuring the participation of the smaller, medium enterprises in the economy. Firms that are owned and run by historically disadvantaged persons, also chairperson members of the PC, require support. And these regulations really are highlighting work that government did and work that government will continue to do to ensure that support is practicalized. Then, of course, there's the COVID block exemptions, which is a more recent, and I suppose it stays in our memory as we're still under COVID restrictions, Chair, but essentially on the back of Section 10, subsection 10 of the Act as amended, government was able to issue, and the minister was able to issue regulations and block exemptions in this case, which allowed for government and various sectors in the economy, those sectors mentioned, the healthcare sector, banking, retail, and others, to be able to react to the COVID pandemic, to be able to support initiatives in ensuring that the pandemic does not worsen and does not worsen the situation in the country. Now the Competition Commission worked diligently, worked very well with the National Consumer Commission chair, members of the PC, in implementing and ensuring that these exemptions that were issued are practicalized and work is done. The presentation that the commissioner will lead will have aspects in terms of reporting on that. So that was a significant one. This one is a highlight, Chair, members of the PC, in that it demonstrates the ability of government really to react in an agile and a quick manner. We are aware that the work of the Competition Commission, the Competition Tribunal, often is work that is detailed, it's work that needs diligence, it's work that takes time. But during the COVID, one of the distinct features that the authorities were able to demonstrate was that even within the environment in which they work, they were able to react quite diligently and agile and very quickly in assisting government and the people of South Africa to be able to manage the pandemic. So these block exemptions are significant in that regard. Another significant amendment which is important in the Act, Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, relates to Section 18A, which relates to measures, proceedings which involve foreign acquiring firms. Now, this section, members will be well aware, requires of the President to constitute a committee which will consider whether the implementation of a measure involving a foreign acquiring firm would have any negative effect on the national security interests of the Republic of South Africa. And as part of that, there are various provisions under Section 18A. I mean, this is just a one-slide summary. One of those key provisions is the President needs to appoint members of Cabinet as well as other public officials as the President sees fit in this committee, publish a gazette of a list of national security interests, and other considering the committee on its part, once it's so constituted, has got obligations in terms of ensuring that major notifications are handled within specific time periods, as well as ensuring that they are then also published in forms of gazettes, and the decisions that committee would then make are published. Now, obviously, in order to adequately implement this section of the Amendment Act, this section of the Act as amended, Chair, members of the PC, it's important that the department also puts in place technical and secretarial capabilities in order to be able to be the legs and the feet of this committee. This is work that is currently being finalized in the department to ensure how do we structure that technical and secretarial structure in the background to support the presidential committee. So it's an important consideration. We are also aware, Chair, that these type of provisions have been implemented in various parts of the world. But while this section is being readied to be promulgated, Chair, obviously working with the Competition Commission on the basis of the relevant provisions of the Competition Act, the department does participate in measure notifications as notified by the Competition Commission from time to time on behalf of the minister. So that is work that is currently being done. We are just about at the tail end of finalizing the modalities of the technical and secretariat capabilities that then allow for the implementation of this section. Another important consideration, Chair, members of the portfolio committee relates to, it is one thing, as we well know, Chair, to have an amendment act with expanded powers. That's an achievement on its own, on the back of Parliament's support. But of course, it's totally another thing for the competition authorities to be equipped and ready to be able to adequately implement those provisions. Now, institutional readiness really refers to the work that was done within the department to look at the competition authorities with regard to the expanded mandate given to them by the Competition Amendment Act, and to say what impact will those amendments have on the financial, human resource, system requirements of the authorities, what budgetary challenges is it likely to pose, including the funding model that perhaps is there need to look at that again or not, and critically, Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, the work around the institutional readiness of the authorities also looked at protocols, internal protocols, particularly with the introduction of 18A, say, do we need to tighten our confidentiality requirements within the department in order to make sure that we keep up the standard that's already well set. Now, it is important to note, Chair, members of the PC, that confidentiality is a non-negotiable. We know this by law, and it is an aspect that the Competition Commission very rightly emphasizes and enforces with great diligence, even in measure participation processes that we as a department participate on behalf of the minister. So here it was really a matter of how do we tighten even our additional responsibilities as a system. And some of the key findings that came out of our institutional readiness work that was done looked at we need to look at institutional model and structure for the Competition Commission that allows it to have readily available a combination of analytical, investigative, litigation skills. This one is on the back of the fact that we have to be conscious of the fact that the authorities go into litigation with entities, with companies, with organizations that will bring their best foot, they'll step up with their best resources. And therefore, we are obligated as well to ensure that the authorities are adequately equipped to be able to match like for like in terms of skills, in terms of competence, experience, and the expertise that are available. So that is one aspect that we believe work needs to be done to just look at very closely and see where the gaps could be there. The other issue would be around on the assumption that you are unlikely to have all the resources that you need in-house all the time, a model of establishing some sort of a panel of experts, economists, cyber, IT, investigators, which the commission could then have access to from time to time based on various types of cases that they would then have to deal with. Now, we know that this panel approach is an approach that has been implemented in supply chain processes, where you have a ready panel that allows an organization to be able to access skills that might not reside in-house. As we know, not all specialist skills, you need them all the time. So it might not be cost-benefit analysis to your advantage to have them in-house. You might want to just have access. As I said, confidentiality is an important consideration, which is that really, Chairperson, it's one of those that we simply cannot overemphasize. It's across that. The pure record keeping and making sure that we tighten those loopholes, any loopholes that might exist there. The other key two points at the department that we are conscious of and we are working with the leadership of the Director General, really, Chair, is around the transmission of institutional memory and the cultivation of intellectual capability. In that, we are conscious of the fact that as members will be well aware, issues, for instance, that relate to competition, mergers, or market inquiries vary and they change. So from each market inquiry, one is health, this, the other one is that different. Mergers and acquisitions, same thing. Now, how do we as a department enhance our own internal intellectual ability to be able to engage at a consistently high level with all the matters that come to the department in whatever way they come, whether it's a major notification or it's participation through a market inquiry? as well as ensuring that we build on the body of knowledge within the department. So internally, we have protocols currently which we are constantly looking at improving in terms of ensuring that we maintain adequate standards and we ensure that we build our internal capacity in the department, critically minding that in the Competition Act, it is the minister who has responsibilities, not the department. And therefore, the work that we do, we are doing really to advise the minister, and therefore we have to make sure that the standards are met. So that's an important part, Chairperson and members of the PC, that as a department, the PC is insistent on us continuously working on. That is also one of the key recommendations that the Institutional Readiness Report advises us to keep an eye on. The other issue, of course, out of the institutional readiness is the implementation of a delegation of authority framework that would allow the commission and the commissioner specifically to be able to separate and focus on legislative strategic issues and have operations also handled by an adequately senior individual in the form of a deputy commissioner in order to assist to ensure efficiency in the organization. So those are some of the key high-level highlights, Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, which quite apart from the provisions of the Competition Amendment Act, which the authorities are, the authorities being the Commission and the Tribunal, are well equipped to lead on and run and implement. The department is also mandated, obviously, because of our oversight responsibility, Chair, members of the PC, to also ensure that those organizations are adequately positioned in terms of skills, in terms of structure, in terms of funding as well, which is an important part. While we are aware that we live in a time now where the fiscus is strained, funding has to be used in a very diligent, ever more diligent manner. Public funds have to be accounted for ever more diligently, now more so than at any other point. We are conscious of the fact that we have to balance that against the fact that with increased mandate for the authorities, there will be a need to look at their funding and say, is it enough? What more do we need to do? And how do we creatively work around? Now, as a last slide, Chair, members of the PC, before I hand over to the Competition Commissioner, if you really were to emphasize or pull out the areas that the department is looking at insofar as implementation of the Competition Amendment Act is concerned, one is to finalize the implementation of 18A, as I so described. The second is to ensure continued engagements with the competition authorities on internal implementation of some of the state of readiness recommendations. I say continued because we know, for instance, that there's already a deputy commissioner acting who's assisting, apart from the permanent deputy commissioner, but there are two other deputy commissioners. So there are already engagements in terms of taking the recommendations of the state of readiness report institutionally and then implementing them within. The delegation of authority framework is also work that is currently in process of being finalized. I've mentioned the funding issue. Funding will always be an issue, Chairperson, in an environment such as ours where the complexity and the cases that the authorities have to deal with get ever more complex. And obviously, the idea is not necessarily to just blindly request more money, but be able to knowingly and with the form of diligence understand where do we need what funding for what purpose and optimize the funding, the limited funding that is available, recognizing that these are public funds, they must be used properly, efficiently and diligently. And then finally, as I mentioned, Chair, members of the PC, we also recognize that the department is not just about the competition authority, it is also about the department as well. So while the Amendment Act, one could mistakenly think, look, it's focused on the authorities and we need to look at the authorities and are they ready? We also need to look at the department and say, is the department equipped? Is the department positioned and is the department building on its capabilities to be able to adequately support the authorities and adequately support the minister and ensure that the Amendment Act fully implemented to realize the objectives of that. So those, that, Chair, in a nutshell, is essentially where we are. So the long and short of it, before the Competition Commissioner comes in, members of the PC, is that the Competition Amendment Act was passed. We are busy working hard with the authorities to implement the provisions of the Competition Amendment Act. We look at it beyond just the Act itself, but we also look at it in terms of the institutional readiness of the system. When I say the system, Chair, I'm referring to the DTIC, I'm referring to the authorities, Commission and the Tribunal, to ensure that as a system of institutions, we are adequately equipped to implement that. And finally, Chair, to make sure that we work with other role players. As I said, one of the good examples, really, I think, has been the work that the Commission has done with the National Consumer Commission during the COVID pandemic, Chair. So that, Chair, brings me to the end of my presentation. I shall hand over now, Chair, with your indulgence, to the Competition Commissioner with his presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Commissioner. I'm sure you'll be able to fly it first and then be able to take us through your part of the presentation. Welcome, Commissioner. I'm sure the team will be flighting the presentation, and then we'll hand over to the Commissioner to take us through.
Thank you, Chair. I would appreciate if that could be done from your side. I seem to be battling to get, I've used Parliament's Zoom, but it seems not to be giving me the options to share.
Okay, Secretariat?
Chair, we made the Commissioner a co-host, Chair, so she should have the ability to share, Chair. But if he's struggling, Chair, we'll see if you are, we can assist, Chair. Just ask Margot to, if she can't share the document for us, Chair.
And Margot? Okay, Commissioner. It looks like it's being projected. Can you see that?
Yes, Chair. I'm just trying to make sure that I've got the right size. I have it, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For now, it now allows me to share mine. So I will do that quickly if you don't mind.
It will be best if the Commissioner shared. Yeah.
I am sharing now, so I have it. I trust you have it, Chair.
Okay, yes, I can see that. You know that when you're talking about sharing and other things, it's not English, because we don't know what you're doing. But we see there's something going off and on the screen.
Thank you.
Floor is yours. No?
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. I will try in my presentation. I have two presentations, which is quite tricky. I will try to avoid duplication. So I will just mention that my colleagues, the DDG, as well as the chair of the tribunal, I've had the benefit of seeing their slides. So where there are duplications with my presentation, I'll just keep those, but I'll inform the members when I do so. It is just to save time. And
thank
you. We, as you would all be aware, the Competition Act, as we have it, came into effect in 1999, but in February 2019, the Competition Amendment Act was signed into law by President Ramaphosa, and soon after that, it came into effect in July, to be specific. These amendments were quite major and took place within the backdrop of what I would term a fairly successful competition regulation over the past 20 years, especially in the area of cartel enforcement. We've seen major cartels in areas such as cement, construction, steel, food, levying fines in excess of 7 billion, and sometimes establishing funds to support firms in some of the affected markets. Besides the success in cartel enforcement, the competition authorities and courts have not been as successful in reining in abuse of dominance by monopolies. This is where you have a single firm conduct. You need no cartel. The power of the firm allows it to control markets. Those have been quite tricky in many assessments that have been done on the work of the Commission. Indeed, the Commission itself did a study in 2018 which confirmed that the markets in South Africa were highly concentrated, and this was confirmed by the World Bank. In fact, the World Bank was the first to do this in 2016. And virtually almost everybody you can talk to about the South African economy, whether it is the OECD, if you like, the institutions that would not typically favor interventions in markets, have all raised some problems on how this economy is working, particularly from a concentration point of view. Because you'll recall that concentration, once you have these dominant firms, they impose costs into the economy. So they are likely to reduce the dynamism of the economy and have a negative impact on growth. So that is why everybody is concerned about that. So the amendments seek to address the concentration as well as barriers to entry in markets by enhancing the mandate of the competition authority. In slide 5, I go into the details of the objective of these amendments, but DDG Molefe-Pule has already spoken at length about this, so I'll skip slides 5 and 6. You will see in the substantive provisions that these amendments touch in almost all areas of the competition functions. So let me start now with one of the areas, the area of cartels on slide 9. As I have indicated, we've been hugely successful in pursuing hardcore cartels, and now there is an acknowledgement that there are also other forms of cartelization that warrant similar attention. So there has been a provision in the Competition Act Section 41A, which created a prohibition or an offence in terms of the Competition Act without a penalty. That is collusion. Any collusion that is not price fixing, market allocation, or bid rigging. So any collusion that outside of that was not regarded as hardcore and did not attract a penalty for the first time offender. So all of those have now been removed. We call these yellow cards because it's almost like a warning when you are found guilty. You will not be fined. Only the second time around could you be fined. So the Act has, the amendment has done away with that, and that section is already in operation. We also have had a market division definition expanded to cover the allocation of market share. So sometimes we found that firms can just agree on what market share to hold in markets without necessarily agreeing on the prices, and that will have a similar effect as that of market allocation. learnings have been carried through into this amendment. The other amendment, which I think is quite crucial, is that now for second time offenders, the penalty has been increased. So there is now a cap of 25% on turnover. There is also an amendment, this is just a procedural issue for those who are interested in slide 10. This is the prescription clause in the Competition Act, found in section 67, where it says that we may not, well, it used to say we may not initiate a complaint if the conduct ceased more than 3 years ago. So, and this has been interpreted as preventing us from even investigating the matter. And the difficulty has always been that as a competition authority, you can't really know the date when the conduct stopped. And so that was introducing a difficulty that you could not even investigate, let alone to refer. So that too has been corrected, because now we can investigate. The only thing we may not be able to do is to refer that case to the tribunal for adjudication if in fact our investigation reveals that it occurred more than 3 years ago. And also there's been some strengthening of our system in the form of fines for criminal offences in Chapter 7 of the Act. These are fines and penalties for failure to appear when you have been summoned and so on. So you can see that there is an emphasis on compliance. Section 5, similarly, you know, Section 5 is similar to Section 4, except that this one applies to firms that are at different levels of the value chain. So similarly, the yellow card provision has been removed there. I should say that for those who may be worried about business, that this section has not come into effect. It only will come into effect once there are regulations that clarify how that is to be interpreted and enforced. And so those regulations are still outstanding. The other area of emphasis on these amendments has been the area of abuse of dominance. You will recall that in the beginning of the investigation presentation, I emphasized the concerns about high levels of concentration. So when a firm is dominant, one form of abuse of that dominant position is to charge excessive pricing. Now we've had huge debates in South Africa about exactly what an excessive price is. It was even defined in the law. And whenever we attempted to enforce the law with such definition, I think we often fell short. We've had some successes at the tribunal, but I think that analytically this just proved to be so complex for us to be able to rein in this type of conduct through the court system. And that's partly why we had to go back to the drawing board, to the policymaker, and say, maybe you can clarify this and make it more flexible. So now that definition has been deleted because it has been found to be unhelpful. In fact, it's a definition we got from an old foreign case, which also does not meet our circumstances well. So now there is a shift in burden of proof on the dominant firm to show that a price is reasonable if there is a prima facie case of an excessive pricing. The analytical framework for assessing excessive pricing also requires determination whether the price is higher than a competitive price. So in other words, there's now introduced a concept of a competitive price. And so you look at whether the difference between a competitive price and the price that the dominant firm is charging is unreasonable by taking into account a variety of factors. That leaves a quite wide scope for doing this. For an example, those list of factors are non-exhaustive, but they are helpful. For example, they do guide us that we now can look at the prices in similar markets elsewhere in the world. We now can also look at a rate of return. So there's a combination of factors we could now look at to arrive at whether a price is excessive or not, rather than having a static definition. So we think that is going to be helpful. We have not had this tested in law. Interestingly, the now test for an excessive price is in the context of price gouging during a national disaster, and we'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about the COVID cases. The other area which has been strengthened is that of exclusionary conduct, again, where dominant firms exclude other firms from participating in the market. There has been a yellow card provision here as well, where some of the conduct could not attract a penalty for first-time offenders. All of that has now also been removed. In other words, all conduct that is deemed to be a contravention in the sense of exclusionary conduct can now attract a penalty. And I think that there is now also an expansion of an exclusionary act to include participating in by SMMEs, participating in a market by SMMEs, as well as historically disadvantaged firms. In other words, the ability or opportunity of such firms to sustain themselves in markets. That's really been the key aspect of these amendments. The other major area of these amendments is that of unfair pricing or other trading conditions. This is what is also sometimes referred to as buyer power. A new prohibition of unfair pricing or unfair trading conditions required that there be a ministerial determination that would designate sectors where these provisions would apply. One of the concerns here was you would have a flood of complaints because by its very nature, this conduct entails contracting between suppliers and their customers. So if you have all of the sectors of the economy subjected to this, you literally would cripple the enforcement agenda because there would be a complaint about all of these contracts. So I think the law tries to open up space so that SMMEs and HDI can participate in this, but also make it practical to enforce. There is also an anti-avoidance clause, so you may not avoid to do business with SMMEs or HDIs in your sector purely because that sector is now subject to these provisions. And the major thing is that there is a shift in the burden of proof to the dominant firm if there is a prima facie case that there is unfair pricing by a dominant firm. As I have indicated, this contemplates a ministerial regulation. The regulation has in fact been published by the minister, and the designated sectors are food and agro-processing, grocery, wholesale and retail, as well as e-commerce and online services. So if you like, the food value chain, as well as more general retail environment, whether bricks and mortar or e-commerce. So in order to further clarify how these would work, the Commission has issued guidelines with details on the interpretation and enforcement approach. So, in other words, we are on track in enforcing this. In fact, there are already cases that we are looking at using these provisions. And we can talk to you about those time meeting. But I'll jump now to the next aspect, which is that of price discrimination. Price discrimination, the major thing that has been done, because it's an old provision, but the major thing here that's been done is that there is now a new species that is aimed at preventing discrimination specifically against small firms or historically disadvantaged firms. So if the discrimination is seen to be likely to impede the ability of SMMEs or HDIs to participate effectively in the economy, the burden shifts to the dominant firm to explain how that is justifiable. So a lot of price discrimination provisions remain as is, except this emphasis that I have mentioned relating to SMMEs and HDIs, because we found that, in fact, these are the ones that also tend to be the victim of this, if you like. So the provision has come into effect. We are just looking also now, because the minister has also done a ministerial regulation on this. We are looking at doing further guidelines to further clarify also how we are going to enforce this from the Commission side. But remember, those guidelines are not mandatory. In other words, it doesn't mean that the section is not enforceable. We just are using it as an aid to both the industry, but also to people who may want to complain, so they know exactly how we would analyze and assess such complaints. So let me also jump now into another area, which is exemptions. I think the DDG has also discussed this. The major change here, which was extremely timely before COVID, was to create a category of block exemptions that could be granted by the minister on our advice for certain industries. This has been effectively used basically to allow industry to deal with COVID-19 shocks, economic shocks. And we'll discuss that when we discuss the block, the COVID-19 cases as well. On measures, I think, again, DDG has dealt with the issues around national security provisions around that. So let me skip that. Then market inquiries, I'm on slide 24. Trying to conclude, the provisions here are also effective. Basically, the aim of the market inquiry was to now elevate the outcomes of a market inquiry into binding findings. So, as you know, in the past, the market inquiries we had would lead to recommendations, and it was up to the parties whether to implement the recommendations or not. The amendment allows us now to effectively, without even going any further step after the market inquiry, to have the market inquiry outcomes enforceable. I should take the opportunity to say that of course, this is an area that is developing that we're quite excited with. Just last week, we confirmed an outcome. recommendation becomes enforceable and binding. So we had to make it an order of the tribunal that the long-term exclusive lease agreement by the large retailers are done away with. We've just reached an agreement with Shoprite Checkers, which was confirmed by the tribunal last week. And today, I think you will be seeing in the media that we've also reached an agreement with Pick and Pay, also doing away with these exclusive lease agreements. I have just given, just for your own reference, a table that gives you the list of these sections that have come into effect and those that are not effective. But basically, they are all in line with what we've discussed. I think the next slide would have discussed the impact of these on the operations and resources of the Commission. I think DDG has done a good job on this, so I also will not take any more time. With that, Chair, we conclude our presentation on the amendments and what we've done so far. And therefore, with your permission, I will immediately jump into the presentation on the COVID-19 cases.
Yes, that's in order, Commissioner. You can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm just also trying to share this, and I have a similar problem, so I can just ask the Secretariat to share that that presentation, because apparently when you share, only then does it allow me to access your system.
Secretariat?
Chair, we'll ask Margaret to share the doc if she can.
Okay.
Chair, once they are sharing, I'm also going to do the same thing. A lot of this is going to be also covered by the chair of the tribunal, so I'll skip some of the slides. The only permission I'll require of you is for our chief economist just to talk you through in the conclusion about the food price monitoring work that we've been doing that he has.
Chair, if the commissioner can stop sharing, please.
Okay. I'm sure Commissioner had that. Start sharing.
Yes. The problem I have is that I don't... I now have some control. Thank you very much. You should now be seeing my latest
yes.
slide. Thank
yeah.
you very much.
Yeah.
I will jump some of the things that I've already said and go straight to the work that we've been doing. So the first thing that I'll talk about is the regulations. So the DDG has already mentioned that immediately we had this national disaster, there were regulations that were propagated by the minister that prohibit dominant firms from charging excessive prices for certain goods, and there were specified goods and services, and these were mainly basic food and consumer items, medical and hygiene supplies. There were also regulations for block exemptions, which were published to enable business to coordinate in order to respond to COVID-19. As I have said, that these block exemption provisions amendments were quite timely, because I think the government was able to use these to, in a way, relax competition laws in sectors where there was a feeling that there was a need for much more coordination in order for South Africa to secure the supplies and services that it needed. There were also special tribunal rules which enabled the COVID-19 bright gouging cases to be heard on an expedited basis. The tribunal chair will talk about that. We have had block exemptions covering the sector, the health sector, the banking sector, retail property sector, hotel industry, liquid fuel, wholesale industry, all to ensure that the country remains safe when it comes to supply and functioning of the economy. Now, coming to the investigations, just to give you a sense of the numbers, we on slide 8 we got more than 1,700 complaints, which is which are complaints we got in the period of 3 months mainly, and these far exceed complaints we would get in the whole year. So our system was quite challenged, both the system of receiving complaints, responding to them during the lockdown, I think was quite a challenging one. And the complaints related to the items that I've mentioned, things like masks, protective gear, as well as certain food items. We decided to pursue this investigation as Section 8 contraventions. We've discussed Section 8 previously, which is a prohibition of excessive pricing by dominant firms. The minister, in terms of these regulations, made provisions on how an excessive price in the context of price gouging during a national disaster should be evaluated. I think the chair of the tribunal will also talk about this. Just to emphasize that these provisions only apply, because they are abuse of dominance, only apply to dominant firms, and there is a threshold for dominance. So any firm that is accused of dominance must have a turnover of 5 million and be in possession of market power. So if you like, that's a jurisdictional requirement. So a small spaza shop somewhere cannot be accused of dominance if it doesn't meet the threshold of a 5 million turnover. This is why, Chair, I should mention upfront that there should be no expectation that we are going to be able to investigate everybody who might have been abusing this period of time, because the law doesn't allow us to investigate micro enterprises that have a turnover below 5 million. The excessive pricing investigations were from all provinces, with Gauteng being the leading province in terms of complaints, but it just shows you that we got complaints from virtually everywhere, with Gauteng leading, followed by KZN, and that followed by the Western Cape. We also have categorized these products. I've already mentioned them, which categories are. We then followed a multi-pronged approach to resolve the cases. I think the most effective and perhaps was the one that is not well acknowledged is that we resolve a lot of cases through proactive advocacy. We reached out to business itself to understand their business models, encourage adequate suppliers, and limit panic buying, and dissuading them from profiteering from the crisis. And advocacy also entails communicating the investigations and processes so that we can educate and raise public awareness. We also had to encourage the public to report these cases through various programs, especially through the media, including social media. The second enforcement mechanism of dealing with this, of course, was enforcement, which is always a very big and important one for us. This is the stick of the Competition Commission. So we prioritized this investigation. We literally had to restructure the organization, the entire organization, to get people working and focused. We formed a joint operations team together with the National Consumer Commission because some of the cases were better suited to be tackled from a consumer protection laws. And as DG Kule mentioned, we worked quite well with our colleagues from the National Consumer Commission. We settled a lot of these cases as well, so not all of them were contested cases at the tribunal. Many of them were also cases against firms that were scattered all over the country, pharmacies and so on. People who really didn't want to be distracted by investigations, and when they were told they had done wrong, they owned up and they were prepared to settle. The two cases that went to the tribunal on a contested basis were the Babelechi case as well as the Dischem case. Those cases were quite difficult for us, but at the same time we're having facts that we thought were very strong, because the price increases and the price margins were quite high. For example, in Babelechi, we saw price increases of facial masks from about 40 rands per box, so from 40 rands to like 500 per box, which was quite a huge increase with a markup in excess of 500%. So that, I think, is a very strong factual background to the case. And the matter has been appealed to the Competition Appeal Court, and we are waiting for that outcome. I should mention that that outcome is going to be quite important for all other cases that we are pursuing in this space. It's going to be a precedent-setting case, and we're all crossing our fingers about where the court will land up. The Dischem case was also another interesting one, but Dischem withdrew his appeal here. So I think the case we're looking forward to is Babelechi. The outcome of these completed investigations as I have achieved has been a lot of settlements. We've tried to really prevent abuse in the settlement, so we've included in the settlement orders corrective action, such as to restrict margins in most instances to about 20% during the national disaster, which we thought was a fair and reasonable margin, which in normal markets would be a good margin. We also included penalties or donation that bear some relationship to the excess profits that were earned. So the donations were to charity organizations, old age homes, as well as the Solidarity Fund. We've done everything to make sure that the illicit profits that were earned during this period somehow were disgorged. We managed to have them paid either to Solidarity or in the form of penalties. The total amount for these penalties and donations was 15.4. You see from the tribunal the number for penalties in terms of consent orders. We've now shifted our focus. These were cases where the consumers bought from retailers. We've now shifted to cases where the public sector was a purchaser. So the procurement of PPE we're getting a lot of information from the Fusion Center, which brings together all the relevant law enforcement agencies looking into PPE procurement and related corruption. Ourselves are specifically looking at excessive pricing to the public sector. We also received specific referrals regarding the purchase of PPE by SAPS as well as the National Health Laboratory Services. Those cases are still in our system and we are still investigating them. We've already referred two to the tribunal. I think the chair of the tribunal also talked about this in her slides. And so we would be looking forward to it. We've been engaging with all of those engaged with this work. The Auditor General, for example, has highlighted some of the overcharging by suppliers of PPE. We are looking at this. Of course, one would have expected that the public sector would protect itself from this through procurement processes, but it does seem that there are instances where there has been clear price abuse. It is at this stage, then, Chair, that I would like my colleague to just talk, and we are just concluding now, about the other piece of work we've been doing during the lockdown, which is very, very important, and that of monitoring crisis. So if our Chief Economist, Jay Torch, could be permitted to talk briefly about this work.
Okay, Chief Economist.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Commissioner. As the Commissioner indicated, right at the beginning of the crisis, we embarked on the monitoring of food prices. And this was primarily because there were complaints about the price of maize and wheat going up in the SAFEX commodity trading market, as well as just the price of essentials at that period of panic buying and lockdown. So while some complaints might identify specific abuses, I think one had to take a more systemic view of what is happening in the market during this crisis, how the markets are functioning, and also to inform a lot of the advocacy work which the Commissioner spoke about. So initially we saw in the first price monitoring report identify that in the lockdown level 5 period and the lead up to that, in the week of panic buying, that really the depreciation of the rand had caused a lot of the globally traded commodities like wheat and rice to go up in price. And the panic buying had also resulted in a spike in demand, and that was exploited by some retailers, but it also had a ripple effect into the wholesale market for fresh produce and the like. In terms of the advocacy work that did stem from that, before I come to the actual monitoring, there was extensive engagements with some of the bigger food producing companies in terms of your essential products of things like bread and milk. And in fact, that advocacy resulted in quite a degree of price restraint, but also clearer guidelines to those companies about their pricing behavior. Because whilst some of the prices for rice or wheat were going up in international markets, the stock on hand would have been bought at a cheaper exchange rate and at a cheaper price. So that ensured that the price of these commodities didn't go up during that initial period of lockdown and was delayed, and sometimes at some cost to the companies involved. But at least they had the clarity and guidance to how we would examine their pricing. In terms of all the actual investigations and why some of the monitoring became necessary, looking at just the first slide, is we started to notice that not just that prices have gone up in some of the wholesale markets, but there were quite big differences across prices in the economy. And that, I suppose, is the advantage of fielding something like 1,700 complaints from all around the country. That very often we reduce the market to our experience in a metropolitan area. And as members of this committee rightly pointed out in our previous engagements and as consumers revealed, in rural areas where people are poorer and incomes are more stretched and there's less employment, often the prices are going up far more substantially. So this is one of the elements we looked at in the food price monitoring report that we just put out. And what we found, just looking at fresh produce markets, which there's many of them scattered across the country, is that the pricing varies quite considerably across them. And an example you've got here is of onions, which are closer to 4.50 a kilogram in Springs, but more close to 6.50 in the Mthatha. And very often we're finding that you know, the Eastern Cape in particular has higher prices for a number of these commodity markets. Now some of these may be explained by differences in logistics costs, but in fact the food price monitoring report identified that that's not really the case. That very often you'll have big price differences between, for instance, the fresh produce markets in Tshwane versus Johannesburg versus Springs or Pietermaritzburg versus Durban. So those don't always explain it, nor where the products are grown. So in fact, apples, which are predominantly grown in the Western Cape, are more expensive there than in other parts of the country, which is something that needs further investigation and explanation. I think the second thing we identified was that these smaller fresh produce markets are far more volatile in their pricing because they're smaller, and one would say less liquid markets, that you see far more movements in price. And so that is something where we need to, again, I think, identify how that market feature can be corrected to ensure that some of these smaller markets are more consistent in their pricing. The other thing we've looked at, which is the slide before you, is the spread between the wholesale price and the retail price. Very early on in the process, farmers complained that, in fact, prices started going down in their wholesale markets for fresh produce, but they weren't seeing this on the shelf. And again, we've just got a couple of examples here of potatoes and onions, but where StatsSA data has finally been released and shows that, in fact, if you look at that wholesale-retail spread, whilst there may have been some increase in wholesale market prices for these products, at the time of lockdown and the immediate sort of aftermath of that, in fact, the retail prices went up far more substantially than the wholesale prices would indicate. And as a result, retail margins greatly expanded onto this. So we are looking with StatsSA at a broader set of essential products to see whether there is a need to, in fact, go back and investigate these more carefully. But it raises the common adage from farmers and consumers that, you know, prices are quick to go up and slow to come down. And if you look at the margins over time, that's precisely what one sees. That, at a time when prices started going down in wholesale markets, that retail doesn't always follow quite quickly. Lastly, just in terms of the stability, and we've got maize and some of the top fresh produce vegetables here. In general, there was a bit of a spike coming into the beginning of lockdown. So there is, if you look at the fresh produce, most of them go up at the beginning of lockdown and the immediate aftermath. And with maize, that middle spike in price was around the sort of March-April period. But the bumper crop has stabilized prices there. I think the stabilization of the rand and the appreciation from where we were, which was closer to 1950 to the dollar, has also meant that these prices have stabilized. But I think you've still got within things like fresh produce some seasonality now kicking in. So despite the sort of initial disruption to the market, hopefully these are playing out. But I think it's highlighted some features that we need to be cognizant of going forward and to ensure that essential food prices remain affordable, because I think that's going to be essential for the years to come, or at least the next year, as we sit in a recession and consumers are under pressure. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, thank you. That's it from our side.
Okay. I think we will then. Yeah.
Can we request that the commissioner stop sharing the document, Chair?
Okay. Now. Okay. And then we can actually then pick up on the last part of the tribunal. Ms. Maswai Mondo will be the last part of what we need to look at. Secretaries, I'm sure the commissioner will stop sharing so that we can be able to pick up on the next and the last presentation to be able to actually get to the committee members to pick up.
Yes.
Commissioner?
We were waiting on the other commissioner to stop sharing. Yeah.
Okay.
Ms. Maswai has the right to share, Chair, so she should be able to share.
Okay. Okay. All right. Tribunal will actually ask for Ms. Maswai.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the members of the committee. If you would
please
to put up the slide so I can share with the members.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Chair, has the commissioner asked us to share the document, or will somebody else in the division share the document, Chair? I didn't get
okay.
The first one.
I am sharing the document, Secretariat.
Okay, Secretariat.
So, Chair, I'm going to be covering two items. It's a pleasure to be here to present on the work that the tribunal has been doing in two respects, the first being the COVID cases, and then the second being an update on the amendments to the Act and the cases that have come before the tribunal in that regard. I'll start by talking about the national response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The members will be aware of the national response, so I will not go into it in much detail. What I'll do is I'll focus on that slide on page 4, specifically on two responses by the national government, which have then impacted the work of the tribunal. The first date on that slide is the 19th of March, which is when the minister issued the Consumer and Customer Protection and National Disaster Management Regulation and Direction. I will speak a little bit more about that later. Then the second is the date of the 3rd of April, where the minister issued regulations on competition tribunal rules for COVID-19 excessive pricing complaint referrals. Against the backdrop of the national response, the tribunal response was then as follows. On the 17th of March, which is 2 days after the president declared a state of national disaster, the tribunal issued a COVID-19 directive, which informed the public that the tribunal will continue to hear matters on the roll as scheduled until further notice. We implemented a social distancing protocol, implemented a register process and procedure for visitors to the tribunal hearings, and we also made provision for staff with comorbidities and other ailments which required self-isolation. Following that, on the 26th of March, which is after the day of the national lockdown, we issued a further directive for the staff to work from home in compliance with the national lockdown. We made provision for electronic filings and virtual hearings. We also prioritized matters relating to the COVID-19 excessive pricing referrals from the Commission. opposed the mergers, which we regard as complex mergers, were not placed on the roll, and this is because these are cases that usually require the hearing of oral evidence with witnesses in the box, where evidence is led by the witnesses rather than arguments being made on the papers, and therefore those matters were shelved. Similarly, complaint referrals, which did not relate to COVID-19, were also put on hold. Then on the 6th of April, we issued a further directive. This is the 6th of April was 3 days after the minister had issued regulations about procedures in respect of the COVID cases. We then quickly issued directives to deal with the time period for the filing, and we truncated the process of hearing these cases. It has been said, I think, by the commissioner that in general, some of these cases can take a long time, particularly excessive pricing cases. To date, there had been only two cases that were prosecuted, being the Sasol and ArcelorMittal matters, which took years before the tribunal and eventually before the higher court. This process of truncating the hearing entails the tribunal undertaking to complete these hearings within a period of 7 to 14 days, depending on the circumstances, but also dealing with consent orders that would come before us within a period of 24 to 48 hours. On the 9th of June, when we went into level 3 lockdown, we made provision for matters to start being heard on site, although in reality we haven't had them on site because we have continued to work well through Teams virtually. Complaint referrals that were also removed from the roll have now been put back on the roll, with provision to be heard in the office with the limited arrangements that we have in terms of social distancing and the necessary protocols. Turning then to the tribunal's work in this period, we looked at the period March to September, March being when the lockdown commenced. And in the 6 months of the year, just on the COVID cases and lockdown period, we've had 87 matters. And we've just done a comparison with the work that was done in a similar period last year. And in that time, there were 68 cases that the tribunal had heard in that period. What we have discerned from the information that we have is clearly that merger activity has dropped due to the economic downturn. And what we have seen instead is an increase in complaint proceedings, particularly those relating to the COVID-19 excessive pricing complaint. This is then borne out by the numbers which are on the slide on page 6. You'll see in the period March to September 2020, we had 52 consent orders compared to the period prior where we had 14 consent orders. We, in the period 2020, March to September 2020, we had 32 large mergers, whereas in the prior period in 2019, we had 49 mergers. It's consistent with the drop in the large mergers that I referred to earlier. No changes in respect of intermediate mergers, and in respect of this year, obviously there is the COVID-19 excessive pricing cases, which would not be there last year because that wasn't relevant. Moving then to the next slide, it's just a pictorial indication of the work that has occupied the tribunal in the six-month period, March to September, and you will see that 45% of the work has been COVID-related cases, and 55% has been the other work that the tribunal does on a regular basis. So I think 45% is quite a big number, and indicates that the COVID cases have really kept the tribunal very busy. In terms of the cases that we have heard, the products involved included face masks, hand sanitizers, eggs, fresh ginger, and maize. And these are all items that, in terms of the regulations issued by the minister, were identified as essential goods necessary for combating the pandemic. And then the firms involved in these excessive pricing violations included pharmacies, both local and those with a national presence. They included hardware stores, wholesalers, as well as food retailers. And then just some interesting information about where most of the cases have come from. The numbers are indicated there in the third bullet point, and that the numbers are consistent with where economic activity mostly lies, with housing having the most number of cases and Limpopo the least, together with Northern Cape and Mpumalanga. The penalties that have been imposed on these firms that have been found to have charged excessive prices is an amount of 8.3 million. And it's important to note that that number does not include donations that have been made to the Solidarity Fund or other charities of choice of the relevant firms that were found to have contravened. It's also important to mention that penalties were not imposed on all the firms, because some of them are small firms, and therefore no penalties were imposed in that regard. The next slide just provides details of where the penalties have come from in terms of the parties who were fined and the penalty amounts that were levied against them. Then to come to the opposed cases, we have in the period had two cases that were highly contested before the tribunal involving excessive pricing. The first one is the case of Babelegi, where the commission alleged that it had charged excessive prices for face masks. Babelegi contested this on the basis that it wasn't a dominant firm. The commissioner mentioned earlier that dominance is defined in one respect in terms of the turnover that a firm has, which is a turnover of 5 million. Another element to define dominance, which is a requirement, is a market share of over 45%. However, the Act also defines market dominance as either having a market share of 45%, or if the firm has market power, it can be considered to have to be dominant. And so with the case of Babelegi, because it was a small distributor of masks with a small market share, one of the contested areas was whether it could be found to be dominant without the requisite market share. And on the evidence that we had before us in terms of the prices that were charged, it's important to also mention that the analysis of the Babelegi case was done in terms of Section 8. I mentioned that the minister had issued regulations that made it a prohibited practice if a dominant firm charged an excessive price. The regulations also provided for a benchmark against which to measure whether a price is excessive or not, and that benchmark was determined based on the date of the margins or markups in December 2019. The reason being that in December 2019, before the pandemic, prices at that time would have been considered to be normal and competitive. And therefore, the price increases that were seen in the Babelegi case were increases, as indicated on that slide, by 592% in February and 987% in March. What we couldn't find in the evidence that was presented before us was any reasonable explanation for the price increases compared to the price increases shortly before the pandemic in the December period. And because there was no valid explanation, that led the tribunal to conclude that that was evidence of market power, even though the company, the listing did not have a market share of 45%. The important point to note about this is that the market power assessment was bolstered by the fact that there were supply interruptions, there was a high demand for the product, there was limited movement by customers who, because of the lockdown, were not able to shop around, and there was also limited imports because of the ban on travel restrictions and imports, and therefore the disruption in normal markets and supply conditions indicated that there was a failure in the market, and therefore that failure in the market conferred market power on a firm as small as Babeleshi. And therefore, without any explanations for the price increases, the conclusion was that indeed there was an excessive price and an abuse of the dominant position in the context of the pandemic. The penalty that the tribunal imposed was 76,000 rand. This exceeded Babeleshi's excess profits, which were about 30,000 rand. The reason for the penalties was taking into account the sections in the Act that govern the determination of penalties, and those include the seriousness of the offence. And indeed, because the pandemic is a life-threatening disease, it was considered serious to a serious contravention. It was also in order to play a deterrent effect on firms in the market in the context of the pandemic. The Babeleshi decision has since been appealed to the appeal court, and it has been heard, and we are awaiting judgment in that matter. The second case was then the Dis-Chem case, also involving an allegation of excessive pricing for surgical masks. The price increases in that context range between 47% and 261%. Similarly, the tribunal found that there was no evidence of any corresponding increases in cost, and therefore found that the prices charged were excessive and imposed a penalty of 1.2 million. Dis-Chem appealed to the Competition Appeal Court, but it has since withdrawn its appeal. Then to turn to cases that are still pending on COVID-19 complaints, we have two which the Commission has referred. One is against a company called Blue Collar Occupational Health, and the second one is against the Dumani Business Enterprises. These cases are different to the Babeleshi and Dis-Chem excessive pricing complaints in that the price increases and the effect of the excessive pricing was not on the consumers directly. In these two instances, the price increase is to the state because both of the cases involve tenders that were issued by the South African police. The matters are still pending currently and will be heard in due course once pleadings have closed and the matters are ready for hearing, so we can't speak much about them at this point. Then if I can turn to the Amendment Act, the DDG and the Commissioner have covered the reasons for the amendments, which came into effect on the 12th of July 2019, but in essence, the amendments were intended to address the high levels of concentration and the lack of diversity in the economy, as well as to address a spread of ownership that was found to be lacking in the economy, and to deal with barriers to entry and encourage broader participation in the economy. What I'm going to do is to then turn to some of the cases that have, since the amendment came into effect in 2019, come before us, which touch on some of the amendments to the Act. I'll do that by looking at mergers, and then I'll look at prohibited practices later. On the merger side, we are required in terms of the Act to protect the public interest, and when we are deciding a merger, some of the considerations we have to take into account are saving jobs and promoting worker participation and the public interest of particularly historically disadvantaged individuals. We also are required to look at small businesses and ensuring that they're able to participate in the economy, while also looking at foreign direct investment and ensuring that the foreign direct investment is still, markets are conducive to attract foreign direct investment, looking at saving businesses and also taking barriers to entry. Then the next three slides speak to the cases that have come before us, specifically on saving jobs. There are about 10 examples of these cases in the next three slides, so I won't go into each one of them. Safe to say that in the 10 cases that I indicated, the significant job savings were made by imposing conditions on the mergers, most of them being by agreement by the merging parties to the moratorium on retrenchment. This is the next slide indicating the cases on job savings. And this is the last slide. It's about 10 cases, just as examples of such cases. Then turning to the aspect of the amendment that deals with protecting worker participation and in the interest of historically disadvantaged individuals. We had one case, Simba and Pioneer. Simba is owned by PepsiCo, a U.S. Company that sought to buy Pioneer Food. One of the elements of the amendment, which is a new provision in the Act, is a provision that requires the tribunal to look at the levels of ownership by workers in the firms that are merging before the tribunal. And this is the first case in which the levels of ownership of the workers was before the tribunal for decision. The issue was whether the merger would result in a dilution in the levels of ownership by workers and more broadly by historically disadvantaged individuals. The merging parties agreed to an ownership scheme which would ensure that the workers would have would be beneficiaries of the trust and that they would continue to be owners of shares in the merged entity. The Foschini merger is one that came before us as a merger that was intended to save jobs because it arose out of the EDCON business rescue process. I think it's common knowledge that EDCON has been in financial distress for some time and they have been in the process of business rescue. So Foschini was one transaction where there were job savings, as mentioned in the previous slide, but in addition to that, there was an undertaking to maintain the existing procurement ratios with the local suppliers, which speak to small business development, which is then the next item on that slide. Simba comes up again here, specifically in respect of the development fund, which it agreed to create to the amount of 600 million in order to develop small businesses. Bondi PLC, an investment of 150 million to assist local communities, and the other two cases also speak to small business development, the Senvest and Marinvest merger. major transaction. Foreign direct investment, Simba again comes up with an investment of 5.5 billion over 5 years. And in respect of saving businesses, Sanvest was a failing firm, as mentioned, because Sanvest had been in financial distress for some time. Adcon is a similar transaction, which was a business which was under business rescue, as mentioned, and we allowed the merger in order to allow the businesses to be rescued, as well as to, in some of the transactions, Adcon had a few transactions. There was the retailability one, there was Foschini, because there was a sale in different of different parts of the business, and in each one of them where local supply could be secured and jobs secured, that happened. Finally, coming to the issue of tackling barriers to entry, we had one merger, which is a merger which was prohibited. Merger was a merger in which Naspers, the Naspers Group, was going to acquire WeBuyCars. WeBuyCars being a large car buying service, which would then be combined with Naspers, various entities that are crucial in the market for car buying services, which include OLX, which is an advertising platform, and a fairly large advertising platform for the sale and purchase of vehicles, also including the Auto Trader brand in the stable of Naspers, as well as other platforms which would see the intersection of the car buying service as well as the advertising services, which led to the conclusion that this would lead to a substantial lessening of competition, as well as increased barriers to entry in the relevant markets, and therefore the transaction was not allowed. We have since subsequently been reported that WeBuyCars has been bought by a new entrant, and that transaction is not before us. We don't know whether it will come before us. Then to turn to prohibited practices, what we have seen before us are emanating from the amendments are market inquiries that the Commissioner also spoke to. There have been three matters which were settled by the Commission and have come before us as consent orders. The two involved the data services market inquiry, in which Vodacom and MTN agreed to settle with the Commission, and the settlement, the essence of it is that it would lead to reduced headline data bundle prices, which affects mostly lower-end consumer groups. That was confirmed as a consent order by the tribunal. And then the grocery retail market inquiry also led to the Commission and the ShopRite agreeing, as the Commissioner mentioned earlier, that ShopRite would remove exclusivity in more than 400 stores in non-urban areas where ShopRite has a presence. And this would allow small businesses to be able to operate and enter into those markets where previously they would be precluded because ShopRite enjoyed exclusivity in those areas. That then is the work that we have done in respect of those two aspects, COVID-19 as well as the amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Secretariat, I think there were just a few slides that were not flighted, which we missed, but I'm sure in terms of the inputs, we're able to get through to that. But I think let's actually thank the tribunal chair for the input. Can I just maybe, unless maybe there's any further final point from the chair, so I'm sure the presentation is actually covered, And I'll come back to the members of the portfolio committee to be able to, you know, make their comments or and or questions to the presentations that we have just received. Can I open the floor to honorable members on questions for clarity and or comments?
Okay.
Yes,
we have Mr. Thring and Mr. Mulder at the moment, Chair.
Thring and Honorable Mulder. If I can check it, Honorable Thring.
Thank you, Chair. I think firstly, we want to appreciate the work done by the department, the Competition Commission and Competition Tribunal. I think as you've correctly indicated, Chair, some of the presentations were not complete and didn't tally with what we have and what was sent to us. So if we could actually get the complete presentations, I think that would actually help, particularly those slides that were missing. But Chair, just quickly, my questions then are as follows. Obviously, I think for those of us who have travel around and maybe go to do oversight or just party and parliamentary work, it is obvious that we have many foreigners occupying some key SME businesses, particularly in the rural areas. The employees here are largely not locals, and this works against our local SMEs and our historically disadvantaged person firms. So how does the Act protect our local SMEs and our historically disadvantaged persons from foreigners in this space, some who are here legally, but more in particular those who are here illegally? The second question, Chair, the Commissioner presenting on the Competition Amendment Act mentioned that one of the weaknesses that they have is dealing with monopolies. Now perhaps this should be better defined as oligopolies. And whether it's monopolies or oligopolies, these have just an adverse effect on the economy and the indigent as cartels. So how can this weakness, the weakness of not being able to limit the effect of monopolies or oligopolies, and what is being done, if anything, to address the weakness? Chair, thirdly, the third aspect I've raised before, and that is that the victims of price gouging and price fixing are the taxpayer and the indigent and the poor amongst us. So fines are levied and at times amounting to millions, and what we've seen presented is just over 8 million in terms of fines that have been issued to those found guilty. But the victim, however, gets no recompense, and this to me is morally wrong. We must look at ways to recompense the victim, whether that be lowering the prices to a specific for a specific period, and using the fines collected to help grow our SMEs and our HDP firm sector as examples. And then my second to last question is on the settlements. Was the 20% reduction corrective action to prices or price margins based on the increased price or the original price before the price increase? Because if it was based on the increased price, where some prices have been inflated by as much as 500 to 800%, then a 20% reduction will still have some of the firms smiling all the way to the bank. And then lastly, what intervention can be used? I think the Economist was presenting on this. But what interventions can be used to address the price stickiness in connection with the wholesale retail sector that he spoke of? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, can I take Honorable Mulder?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to all the presenters. Let me first also appreciate the work that the Commission and the Tribunal has done. The Competition Commission and the Act has indeed got an important role to play in ensuring and overseeing a fair business environment in South Africa. Let me say from the outright myself and the party that I represent very pro-localization, the development of local economies against mega stores and chain stores. I believe that a lot could be done to enable these small, medium enterprises to flourish. It is, however, confirmed in the presentation that when the Competition Act was first passed in 1998, the main objectives was to address the legacy of the legal cartels, monopolies, highly concentrated markets, and the exclusion of black people in the mainstream economy. It is also stated that the policy objectives of the Act is to open the economy for greater investment in new businesses, the focus on opening up space for small, medium enterprises and black-owned business. Now, if we really want to create jobs, job opportunities in South Africa, and create an ideal business climate and integrate, well, for small, medium enterprises to strive and sustainable, we should educate a highly skilled population of motivated entrepreneurs. These entrepreneurs should not be functioning in the culture of entitlement, but rather on healthy business principles. Now, as my colleague, Honorable Thring, also stated, state capture and corruption has already left the economy in a very weak and unfavorable situation. Even before COVID-19 and with COVID-19 even making it worse. Now, to enable us to achieve the goals of the DTI and the Competition Commission, as enshrined in the Act, to create economic growth is a very key factor. Economic growth is very, very much necessary in these circumstances. Unfortunately, South Africa has not experienced economic growth for quite a while. Now, in a weak economic environment, a very delicate balance has to be found as far as sustainability and buying power is concerned. The balance of the scale of the Competition Commission should be more in creating a fair business environment and not merely to redistribute resources according to legally enforced quotas and racial-based codes. Now, Chair, my question to the Commissioner, with this background, he would be to Commissioner Bonakele, if he can assure me that the implementation of the Competition Amendment Act of 2018 and the conducting of the business of the Commission and the Tribunal in enforcing the regulators' regulations, especially in a challenging economic climate, the focus will indeed be on overseeing a fair business environment and not mainly about redistributing existing resources. Thank you, Chair.
Can I just check further? Yes, or Secretary?
Chair, Mrs. Hermans hangs up, but she lowered it. I don't think that's still the case, but Mr. Mantashe and Mr. Mbuyane, Chair.
Mantashe and Mbuyane. In that order, Honorable Mantashe.
Thank you very much, Chair. I also want to appreciate the presentations that we have just received, Chair. As they were presenting, I just a question just came to my head with the extended mandate of the Commission. Where the presentation said they had to appoint deputy commissioners, two of them. And I thought of that and I compared it with the contraction or the reduction of budget. And I want to ask, how are they going to manage that point, Jay? Yes, I know that those votes are a necessity in the Commission, but it's also a fact that budgets of entities have been reduced. How are they going to manage it? Chair, we appreciate the interventions that have led to saving jobs of our people during this period of COVID-19, Chair. but we also wish that it could be, it could happen that they save jobs going forward, even beyond COVID-19, if there will be a beyond COVID-19. But Chairperson, I've observed the interventions they've done in as far as price hikes are concerned during this period of COVID-19. But I had submitted earlier on when in the middle of the pandemic, and I made a request to the Commission to make an investigation of the prices of eucalyptus oil, which eases the tightness of tests for COVID positive people. I don't know whether it was because I submitted this request as an individual, and I wish to submit it now, Chair, officially, that they must do that investigation, because its price has hiked. It is three times the original price that we know. And I request that this be taken into consideration, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Honorable Mbuyane.
Chairperson, good morning, and I appreciate Chairperson the opportunity. Chairperson, let me first acknowledge the presentation, and I have just some few clarity-seeking questions around those presentations. Maybe I'll start with one of the Competition Commission. Can the Commission update the committee on the situation of possible abuse of dominance in the fishery industry? Second one, Chairperson, the competition cases are prolonged and small business and consumers continue to suffer while the case is on. I just want to check what measures can be implemented as an immediate intervention on allegations of collusion, abuse of dominance by big business. Is there any need to develop a regulation? The other one will be the issue of the state of competition in the healthcare center, specifically private healthcare center and regulatory failures, and high barriers to entry, hospital licenses controlled by few big players. The last one from the Commission, I think we can get an update in terms of the implementation of the Committee Amendment Act, which was signed in 2019, Chairperson. Then coming to tribunals, can we just be clarified in terms of the turnaround time on queries or cases, Chairperson? As I indicated earlier on, that cases are being prolonged and are not being leaked. Also, can we be informed in terms of how do cartels get involved in water and sewer issues, Chairperson? Moreover, I just want to check how do the triple BEE police influence the adjudication in terms of the tribunal. The last one, Chairperson, will be any example or eskimos behind the reported for collusion behavior, Chairperson. That would be the last one. Thank you for the opportunity.
May I check, Honorable Hammonds, if ever that you still wanted to say something to us? Secretary said there was a raising of your hand. Can I check?
Thank you very much, Chair. My apologies. You know, when we're on these virtual platforms, we get other disturbances. But thank you very much for acknowledging me. I want to take this opportunity, Chairperson, to thank the Competition Commission. Sorry? I want to take this opportunity to thank the Competition Commission and the Tribunal for the good work that they have been doing. We've really had an opportunity to sharpen our tools that we have in our work box in order to protect abuses within the sector. So we have seen firsthand how the minister's ability in terms of legislation to impose block exemptions has assisted us during COVID-19 as we went into the state of disaster and we had to quickly attend to what was needed to fight COVID-19. So it has allowed us and given us the space to be quick to respond to address critical challenges. So that is where we can see the effect of the amendments, and it was good that it was in place. On the issue of penalties of 10%, I think we must, as a portfolio committee, propose that we revisit the 10%, because it's 10%. And then for a second offense, it goes up, etc. But I think 10% for a big player in any sector, it can just be a little slap on the wrist, and next time we'll do it again. So I think we as the portfolio committee must look at the penalties that are imposed and how we can make sure that it is more punitive, so that the big players who transgress in the field can be made to feel what their wrongdoing has done to the sector. So I just want to ask that we reconsider and as a portfolio committee look at that. But well done to the tribunal and the commission for their good work. Thank you, Chair.
Secretariat, I'm not sure if ever there's still any further hands.
Mr. Mutahum, Chair, would like to ask a question, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Mutahum.
Thanks, Chair, for the opportunity. I have only one question to the Commission. I just want to check with the Commission, how did the pandemic affect the impact on your fiscus, and how that you have, no, I just wanted to double check, how did the pandemic affected the impact on your fiscal pass? Now that you have a lot of cases versus the number of investigators that you have, when I'm checking the delay of some of the cases to be finalized. Thanks, Chair.
Chair? Okay. No, thank you very much. So can we just ask DDG Dr. Pule, would actually then ask you, in terms of picking up on the comments and questions from members, to actually have that dialogue, so discussion, maybe actually guide us through the members of your team in response to and comments to the questions. Dr. Pule.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee. There are quite a number of questions, and most of them from my notes here, Chairperson, seem to be directed to the Competition Commission. So I can't read all of them out. I hope that the Commissioner, I know that the Commissioner has noted them. There were a few that I thought before I hand over to the Commissioner, I could just pick the address and then we'll hand over to the Commissioner, because it's a couple for him. And the Chairperson, I noted a question for the Chairperson of the Tribunal from the Honorable Mbuyani on the turnaround times on the cases. There was an issue around water and sewer cartel, I believe. Commission could also deal with that. There was a question specifically around the, how BEE legislation affects the decisions of the tribunal, I believe it was, from the Pembuyani. And then there was also an issue around, so I think those were the ones directed specifically at the tribunal, if I'm not wrong. Chairperson will correct me if I'm wrong. Then most of the issues really were for the commissioner. Honorable Tring mentioned one witness in dealing with monopolies. Others which we can just check. The one that I wanted to start with, I think there were two chair that the department would want to just quickly address. Honorable Tring asked a question around foreign employees. How does the Act protect locals from illegal foreigners? I think, Chair, and I think that the Bonagele will come in also with his take on this one, but it's an issue that has previously been discussed. By my recollection, PC, and the bigger context really around that issue, Chairperson, is firstly the sensitivity around the recognizing foreign nationals who live and work legitimately in South Africa. I think that's an important part, to recognize that, you know, there are foreign nationals who live among us as South Africans legitimately so. Individuals, obviously, Chairperson, who are in the country on illegal grounds are subject or should be subject to the necessary legal process. To my recollection, to my knowledge, Chairperson, the Competition Act does not necessarily say anything about foreign employees or foreign illegal nationals. And I think the emphasis here should be on illegal, because I think we can agree, Chairperson, that those foreign nationals who are legal in the country are legal in the country, and they've got the necessary rights and responsibilities that go with that legal status. So I think that's one part. I think the other part of the response, Chairperson, should really be around emphasizing the positivity of the Act, in that as opposed to necessarily being against a particular category of citizens or people in the country, really the emphasis should be on what the Act stands for as opposed to what it stands against. And I think what it stands for primarily is, how do we work within the laws of the land to ensure effective participation for all people residing in South Africa in economic activity in a fair and just manner. I think that's the priority. Now, the one part, I think, and this is where I think James Hodge might also have something to say around specific recommendations, for instance, coming out of activities such as the market inquiry, the grocery retail market inquiry being an example, would for instance, look at addressing specific aspects or specific behaviors that have been identified in the economy as being anti-competitive. As an illustration, one of the recommendations of the grocery retail market inquiry is around, and this is not illegal persons, but illegal counterfeit goods, as an example. And I'm just going on the theme of the illegality, Chairperson. And so where there are such findings, such recommendations that need to be followed up, the department, the commission, as Commissioner Bonagele rightfully say, often we underestimate and we underemphasize the advocacy work done, really. We would work with relevant stakeholders and agencies to ensure that those are there. I mean, in the case of the grocery retail market inquiry, just to continue on that theme, we are currently in engagement and discussions with the South African Revenue Service, legal counterfeit goods in the grocery retail market venue chain. So I think that really, Chair, is the response to that, the recognition that we look at that within the bigger context, and sensitive to our experience in the country previously around issues of xenophobia and making sure that in handling anything around foreign nationals in our country, we handle it with sensitivity, with the necessary empathy, but also firmly within the prescripts of the law. I think that's an important portion. Then the second issue, several points, is around the appointment of two deputy commissioners and the issue there raised by a member of the committee, Mem Mantashe, was around, given the budget, how is that going to be managed? And that's a very important point, because the Director General often makes this point that we live in an environment and in a time where fiscal austerity is a priority. And therefore, any intervention that we are going to implement, the minister and the DG are going to implement in the oversight responsibility on the entities, will obviously be done within the context of that fiscal environment. Now, as was also mentioned by the member when she asked the question respectfully, she also acknowledged that we need to acknowledge the criticalness of these posts, but we need to make sure that when we do those appointments, we do those appointments in the context of what is affordable versus in the context of what is required. And therefore, really, we cannot argue with that point, Chair. That's a very fair point. That's a very valid point. That's a point that echoed. The question specifically was how we're going to handle it. The manner in which the DG is guiding and the minister for us to handle it is to look at the entire context of what is required by the entities and to be able to make a balanced decision in terms of what needs to be done. At the moment, Chair, there are two acting deputy commissioners supporting the commissioner at the moment. And therefore, there's still scope for the minister and the DG to apply their minds, considering what are the priorities. And we know now that, for instance, with the medium-term strategic framework being revised, the president having issued the economic recovery plan and others, we also have to look at, we're in the middle now as well, Chair, conveniently of finalizing annual performance plans and the like. We have just finalized annual reports. So we are in a very good environment and time now to look at all the issues that could impact on whether those two additional DCs are appointed. Of course, that's a ministerial prerogative, but Minister and DG obviously will take advisement in terms of the practice. So it will be handled by looking at the entire context of what is required. We are very much conscious of the fiscal environment. The pinch is getting stronger and stronger, but as it gets stronger and stronger, one thing that I've heard the commissioner say, we also have to be clear about how we handle the demands that are put on the end. Chairperson. I do not think there's anything else for now. There was, of course, we wish to echo, and on behalf of the DG, I think I should acknowledge Member Herman's point around acknowledgement of the good work of the Commission and the Competition Tribunal. And also, perhaps the Commissioner might want to chime in on this one, acknowledge the point that she raised around the issue of the 10% penalties and that the PC might want to look at this further. Those are the issues for now. I would like to hand over now to Commissioner Bonake, and I think there were specific issues which were addressed, and then finally appeal to the Chairperson of the Tribunal as well, if she would like to respond. Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Chair. And again, with your permission, I'll ask my colleagues to assist me in responding to the questions. Specifically here, I noted there was a question about the stickiness of prices going down. And I think the chief economist may enlighten all of us here. We are all have observed from his presentation this point about the prices taking time to come down once they go up, this is when the costs go down. So that's really an economic question I may need assistance in addressing, but the deputy commissioners are also here. They can assist where they need to. With your permission, Chair, if I can ask James to go ahead.
Yes, that's in order, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. In fact, I think the announcement which the Commissioner made around an agreement with Pick n Pay today and ShopRite, which was confirmed last week, is an important part of addressing price stickiness, because the extent of competition in grocery matters. And what we have noticed is that there are higher margins for fresh produce, for bakery and butchery, where convenience may matter, and where the exclusion of even these specialist stores that may compete in shopping malls, convenience centers nationally, enable supermarkets to keep prices high and not be as responsive. So I think that those agreements will take us a long way in towards starting to address this. But there are also differences in power and economic power in the food value chain. And we've noted the importance of that food value chain and participation and concentration in that in terms of the recovery plan. And so this is a focus for us. And you know, just to provide some example, which also goes to the point around fairness in the economy and the new amendments. But a lot of the amendments around buy power and price discrimination are precisely to ensure fairness, so that those who enter can expand and become competitors one day. And that is I think, the important element of supporting SMEs and historically disadvantaged persons in the economy, with that longer-term goal of more dynamic competition. But to provide an example, you know, of enforcement of buy power during the COVID, with the immediate lockdown, there were a number of dairy processors that announced immediately the imposition of levies on dairy farmers, or the removal of some of the price benefit premiums that they had previously had. And that was done unilaterally without consultation, and in fact without even examination of the true costs of having to deal with the lockdown situation and the true impact on their own products. So swift action from ourselves ensured that balance between the processor and the farmer was maintained, that consultations did take place, and any additional charges that were required or adjustments to the market were done collectively. And that did result in far less harm. Had we not had those powers which were passed in the amendments and had not acted, then it's quite feasible that much of the almost negative impact of COVID would have been on dairy farmers, which would have cut production ultimately and shrunk the sector in the long run. So I think the actions around competition in the food value chain and addressing those bottlenecks and concentrations are an important part of addressing that price stickiness. Because even if prices would have come down to dairy farmers, they weren't coming down from the processor to the retailer either. Hopefully that answers some of that question.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair. I wonder if the Deputy Commissioner wants to say something, then I'll switch quickly.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner, and to the Chairperson and members of the committee. And thank you again for the encouraging message of support and recognizing the work we're doing as the Commission. And there are questions I will tackle, and then, of course, the Commissioner said you will do the sweeping. But I thought we should start with this question of distribution, because this is the core of what we do as the Competition Commission. This is the core of the Competition Act. The Competition Act is designed to address injustices of the past and exclusion. This is not just looking at illegal monopolies that we have successfully broken up, particularly those involved in cartel activities. This is to address the apartheid legacy of exclusion, which shows even today in the nature of the market we see, highly concentrated structures of the market, structures that exclude SMME from participation in markets. So the issue of distribution is a constitutional imperative. And indeed, the Competition Act is meant to ensure that our markets are competitive, our markets are inclusive, and you can see in the nature of the amendment that we have now, these amendments pay specific attention to implementing measures to promote access to SMEs. So the two are not mutually exclusive. So we focus on distribution, and I've been looking at the charts, Honorable Mundla. This is not the distribution. It's not the distribution we are talking about. There has to be an equitable distribution of resources, fair opportunities to participate in markets. And this talks now to the question, and I've tackled issues of cartels. There are indeed, of course, monopolies and oligopolies that we still have to tackle, but there are new ones as well. So the law is continuously being refined. The commissioner has aptly presented the kinds of challenges we faced in tackling abuses of dominance, and we hope, and we've started seeing some successes in court on abuse of dominance. We eagerly wait the ruling in the Babalehi matter on excessive pricing, because this case would definitely give us a clarity on how we should be, and hopefully it does so, because if it doesn't, there would be a serious consequence for enforcement. So we...
I found this on the web.
We have... there's a question from Honorable Buyane on private healthcare. I'll be very brief on this because we have conducted the health market inquiry. The report has been released, and I know, Chair, that we are yet to brief. I think we have, if you correct me, whether we have fully briefed you on this and subsequent implementation of the private healthcare inquiry. Indeed, there are huge challenges of licensing. There are huge challenges of competition in the private healthcare market that we have to attend to as the commission. And issues of I think the eucalyptus matter, we would be, you know, we would look at this again, Honorable Mantashe, and I think you're welcome to provide further information to the commission on this. And lastly, I would, and I think the commissioner would look at other questions, I would just touch on this. There was a question by Honorable Ring on the 20% that we import in various consent orders subsequently confirmed by the tribunal. The 20% was to restrict the margin, so we kept the gross margin from 20%. So where firms were earning excessively high margins for these essential products we identified, we reduced this margin significantly and required them to cap these 20%, and we didn't have resistance. So our bottom line was to ensure that the firms do not earn excessively high margins, and we have seen successes because there has been a lot of price stability in some of these products, particularly in the pharmaceuticals, where we're having a whole lot of other challenges, and you have seen in retail some stability as well. But there are other similar issues that we are tackling outside of this. So, Commissioner, I would just cover those, but I can cover more if you want. I'm looking at the time as well, that maybe you can cover the rest.
Thank you. Indeed, I will. Chair, I nearly forgot the Deputy Commissioner mentioned the complaint by the Honourable Mandashe. Is perhaps fair to give the manager responsible to give an answer to Honourable Mandashe, because we've made some progress with in relation to that complaint. I don't know if Kanye is here to update Honourable Mandashe on that specific complaint.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning to the Honourable Members. So the complaint from Honourable Mandashe has been investigated, and the team is coming to a conclusion on the matter. Essentially, this was about eucalyptus oil, as she has mentioned, which is a product which is used pharmaceutically to bring relief, you know, for cold and flu symptoms, and particularly pertinent during this COVID period. And so the complaint related to a price hike which seemed excessive relative to other retailers in the area. This is Queenstown, Staterheim area. So a general trader, they had been selling these from 50 Rand initially, but moving them up to 150 Rand for a 50 milliliter bottle. So on our engagement with the respondent, it became apparent that initially he sourced his supply from Massmart at a much lower cost. He started trading this from July 2020, but Massmart soon ran out of stock, and it seems there was a shortage of stock in general on this particular product, which we understand is quite popular. He therefore sourced his supply from an informal trader in the area. We even tracked down his name is Mr. Sbusiso, and we could not get his surname. But essentially, you know, he explains then the higher charge based on his new supply line or supply chain in the short, in the absence of stock from conventional suppliers. And of course, this is a small trader. The turnover is, you know, around 600,000 rand per annum. He was not even able to produce financial statements to us. So certainly, you know, falls under that threshold which the commissioner had indicated for prosecution of 5 million rand. But nevertheless, you know, we, you know, did engage with him around this conduct. So he did reduce, or at least commit to reduce his prices by 20%. We found that also when we calculated the profits, excess profits that he had made, you know, in these last few months that he was trading at the higher volumes, you know, relatively speaking, because of the small volumes, he had sold about 30 of these, between 30 and 40, you know, they were also of quite a low threshold, you know, for further prosecution, but we did engage, and I think, you know, there was a sensitization on his part around these issues of price gouging and excessive hiking of prices. But, you know, the team has engaged with the Honourable Member, you know, particularly in the initial stages of the investigation. I think we even sent a courtesy letter, but we will be giving you more detailed feedback on the conclusion of this matter once we have tied up the loose ends on our side. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. If I may quickly now do the last questions, Chair. I think the issue of foreigners was addressed by the DPG. Sorry, Chair, I think I was muted at some stage. On the question of foreigners, I would just provide information without debating the issue. Just for honourable members to follow some of the developments. I think a major development regarding foreigners is this clause in the amendment bill which was discussed by the DPG, which subjects certain sectors of the economy that are regarded as security sensitive to a process of approval by the executive in case there is a merger by a foreign firm. The second issue to watch, which we will be watching as a commission, is a bill that has been introduced by Gauteng province to restrict the participation of foreigners in the retail sector in certain parts of the province, like townships. As far as the Competition Act is concerned, there are no other specific provisions regarding the protection of locals. Right? That's just what I should provide that information. And the issue around the role of the Competition Act in distribution has been, I think, adequately addressed. I could just make a further example to illustrate this point, because our chief economist discussed the issue of the relationship between farmers and processors buy the milk from farmers and often possess market power. They dictate prices that farmers pay, and so our interventions in a sector like that does have a distribution effect, because essentially you are wanting to distribute where the surplus goes between the farmer and the processor. And so the issues of distribution, yes, do include race, but they go far beyond that. There are many dairy farmers, SMMEs, who come to us, black and white farmers who come to us and say that you need to promote distribution in the milk value chain, because it's unfair, the power is tilted more in favor of the processors and retailers. So competition by its very nature does impact on the distribution. You know, it's about the share of the surplus generated by the economic activity. Now, the issue also of the budget, I think, has been raised, and the DDG is here. I should just mention, because I want to combine this question with the question raised by the Honorable Mutaung, I think it would be unfair of me not to indicate to the committee that indeed the lockdown period has been quite a challenging one for our staff. They've had to do all of these investigations which were not on the original plans. We've had people moving around divisions where they were working to focus just on these cases. And it did put a lot of strain on our staff. You will recall that we had to be all over the country, literally. There were no planes that were flying at the time. People had to drive long distances conducting the investigations. We had to get people into risky places like stores at the height of the COVID-19. And also just the way that the shutdown operated induced quite a lot of stress, because people had to work from home. So I think that, yes, it has had a huge impact on our budget situation, on our funding, but also it has had quite a huge psychological impact on our staff. I think even the idea of working from home, I don't know, I mean, in our organization, we've had, for example, to introduce a psychologist service provider who is working with our people because we've noticed that there's an increase in mental health issues. So I think that there's a whole briefing we can make just outside of cases about the impact of this on on the people, on our people, on the budget, and on our operations. I can feel it myself. I know for sure that I'm working under more severe strain now than I did before the lockdown. And DTG has explained, for example, that we do have acting deputy commissioners, and they too have been under strain. I mean, to be acting means that you are having two positions that you are responsible for. And in the case of the commission, those positions come with a lot of work. And so I think, yes, we will have more discussions with the department about this, but I think the questions from honorable members are definitely spot on. On the question of the fishing industry, yes, we have been engaged a lot about this industry. We think that dominance in this industry is partly also a function of the distribution of fishing rights by the responsible department. It's true that it's a fairly concentrated sector. The department has now, only just now, through our engagement, started reserving some of the fishing rights for smaller fishing communities and companies coming from those areas. We've seen a lot of consolidation, particularly on the processing side of fish. I think that we can, and we've done some work as a commission on this, but all I'm saying is, honorable members, that this work could be made much easier by making sure that, because the fishing sector is a regulated sector, because those fishing rights are issued by the state, and I think that we can, if we can tighten it there, we would address a lot of the other issues. And honorable Buyane, we would be this is an area where we could take a whole hour briefing you on all the cases, the whole history here. But you ask what one, there are a lot of problems in the fishing industry. And just on the on this question that I think has been taken up by the committee around fines. I would like that maybe you add some of the questions that keep coming about penalties, about why the penalties go to the National Revenue Funds and are not used to remedy the damages that are caused in markets by these monopolies and cartels. Again, that's a legislative matter. The fines do go to the National Revenue Fund. And National Treasury is very protective of that process, and there is nothing much we can do about it. It's a matter of legislation. I think that the issue around the sewer and water issues. Also, I note here that we have a lot of concerns that we have received from the department itself that's dealing with this, but also we've had in the past investigations here around the supply of water treatment chemicals. We have a fairly concentrated market there with only a few players, where the water utilities and municipalities have to buy the chemicals. So that's a very chain that we are looking at. There is also a lot of suspected cartelization of the provision of engineering services for water treatment works and the like. I think it's going to be a work that we would be faced, we would be having a major project on in the future. Chair, I think we've covered almost everybody. My apologies up front if I've missed anything. But thanks very much for the opportunity.
I'm sure Commissioner will be checking with the Tribunal Chair if there are any issues. Before we go back to Dr. Pule. Okay. I'm just I was just checking DDG if ever there's any comments from the tribunal. If not, I'm sure we'd actually try and ask you to round up.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, there's two members who would like to follow up questions, Chair, Mr. Mbuyani and Mr. Singh.
Okay. All right. Can we take Honorable Mbuyani and Honorable Tring in that order?
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much. I think there's this issue of triple PE policy. How does it influence adjudication in terms of the tribunal? I was not covered on that one. And also, Chairperson, on the two issues that I've raised, it's not for the first time raising this issue. And the very same department is dealing with the matter, The issue of water and sewer and the issue of healthcare in private sector. I don't think even if the department is dealing with the matter can drag to this law. Even update, I can get an update, how far are they in terms of checking or investigation the dominance? Probably they are agreeing with me that there are regulatory some issues there. But what is it that they've done currently? Because really this is concentrated. People have got dams, but there are people that don't have water. How do you justify that in the Republic of South Africa, Chairperson?
Thank you. Honorable Queen.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just a fairly simple question. I think one of the presentations, the mention was made of some of the fresh produce where there were some price hikes. And one of those fresh produce was I think, ginger. And I can recall my wife mentioning that just prior to lockdown, the price of ginger was around about 70 to 80 rand a kilo. And then a week or so into lockdown, she had to purchase it for in the region of about 140 rand. So there was almost like a 100% increase in the price, 140 rand per kilo. So within the space of a week, you had that 100% increase. I'm just interested to know, much like with, and now this is in your major supermarkets, you know, your Pick and Pays, Spars and Checkers and so on, where we've seen these particular price hikes. Thank you, Chair. So my question is, I just wanted to know whether there's, I heard that there was an investigation into the ginger. What was the outcome?
Okay. DDG, Dr. Pule, if I can go back to you and then let's actually get the commissioner and the tribunal to, if ever there are any further points. Dr. Pule? If your line is bad, Dr.
Is it not clear?
No, much better now.
Oh, I was saying, can we request the tribunal chair? Because I think the issues that Mbuyani, one of them was for her. And then I think, I don't know if Commissioner Bonakela wants to come back on the water and sanitation. And the first produce will be games watch from the commission. And, Chairperson Tribunal?
Thank you, DDG. The question from Member Mbuyani to the tribunal was about the length of time it takes to complete cases. The second question is a question that was asked in the second round, and I didn't quite get that question about BEE. So if Member Mbuyani could repeat that question. In the meantime, with your permission, Chair, I'll proceed to answer the first question, is about the tribunal turnaround times on cases. I think when one looks at the turnaround times, there are two aspects to look at it from. One is from the merger side of our work, and the other is from prohibited practices side. On the merger side of things, I don't have the figures with me, but the tribunal substantially meets the timeline stipulated in the Act in terms of deciding mergers, even with the constrained capacity that it does have. In respect of prohibited practices, the Act doesn't stipulate time periods for the completion of those matters. But the factors that do affect and impact the turnaround time from a tribunal perspective are numerous, and I'll just mention a few of them. One of them is the issue of the complexity of the cases. If one looks at our statistics, and I don't have those in front of me, in general you find that in respect of cartels and behavior that competition violations that are egregious, which also are supported by the Commission's leniency policy, those cases tend to move quicker because the evidence is there and the parties come forward to confess. In respect of abuse of dominance in particular, that area involves quite complex economic and legal analysis. And so even before the tribunal gets to hearing the matter, often the case takes long because the parties themselves are contesting various aspects of the case. So the complexity of the matter is basically one reason why the delays in decision-making come about. The second is also related to interlocutory proceedings that also tend to delay matters. So interlocutory proceedings are applications where parties bring cases or request information before the matter can proceed to its merits. And some of those matters will, for instance, be for access to documents before the parties can then go on to the merits. Sometimes it's jurisdictional issues that are sometimes appealed to higher courts. And therefore, before you can even begin hearing the merits of the case, one would have then had to deal with those interlocutory applications. And what we do see, again, the statistics are not here, is that there's a correlation between the complexity of the case and the number of interlocutory proceedings that happen. So the more complex the cases, the more there's a contestation before even the hearing about access to documents, about jurisdiction, about a whole number of procedural matters that need to be addressed. So that's the second reason. And then the third reason is the issue of member capacity as well. We have also been operating under very tight numbers. There are four tribunal members, and the four include myself as the chair and the deputy chair and two tribunal members. So the cases that I referred to earlier that I was mentioning the tribunal has been dealing with during this lockdown has primarily been on the shoulders of those four members. And again, just to remind members that the tribunal matters require a sitting of three members per case. So as I sit here today in this a presentation, the other three tribunal members are hearing cases in the tribunal, and that's the full extent of the members. So the three of them are hearing cases this morning, and part of what happens then after the reasons, as you would appreciate, is reason writing. That also requires a lot of quiet time of actually doing reason writing. So there's a whole number of factors that cause delays. We do have part-time members. The part-time members have been able to assist during this lockdown period because they are able to work from home and therefore have been more available to assist on the cases. The part-time members are six part-timers, and one is not entirely in control of their time. time in terms of their availability to the tribunal, and we are not in control also of when matters come before us to plan with the part-timers as to their availability. So it's a situation that we manage on a day-to-day basis, and we, I think, manage to comply as much as possible to the to the timelines with the limited constraints. The DDG mentioned earlier that the pinch is getting stronger, and I can confirm that from a tribunal perspective in terms of the work that we have handled in this period and our limited capacity in terms of the number of people who can sit on the cases. If Member Mbuyane could then repeat for my benefit the second question on BDD, then I'll answer that question.
Honorable Mbuyane.
Chairperson, thank you very much. It's a very straightforward question, Chairperson. I just want to check how do BEE policy influence the tribunal adjudication in terms of measures and public interest? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Chair, Tribunal Chair.
Yes, Chair, we do look into BEE. We are required in terms of the Act to look at BEE in merger assessment. And some of the cases that I referred to in the slides that I put up earlier do address that issue squarely, where the BEE elements come in various forms. One that I mentioned specifically, which I indicated was a new one under the amendment, is one that looks at the levels of worker ownership in the firms that come before us. And in the Simba matter, that was a matter that squarely came before us, and there was a condition to ensure that workers would have ownership in the merged entity. And the focus was also on historically disadvantaged persons. There are numerous other matters in the slides where BEE, also from a perspective of small businesses, is also taken into account in considering mergers. And in respect of prohibited practices, that's an area where it's difficult to know whether the impact is on small businesses directly as opposed to in merger cases. However, it's a constant prism through which we look at transactions and complaints before us, as we are required in terms of the Act.
Dr. Bule, I'm sure. Yeah.
Chair, I think there was one more question around ginger. I think import fresh produce from Honorable Tring. James, do you want to cover that?
Thanks, sir. DDG, there's also a question about the water rights. If maybe Bakke can quickly address that as well.
No problem. Thank you, Commissioner. Ndate Bakke, you'll be up next after James. James, please proceed.
Thanks, DDG. On the price of ginger, what happened in the wholesale market, and this is covered in our price monitoring report, is that ginger in wholesale markets and fresh produce markets went up to around 90 rand kilogram in that first week of lockdown. And the regulations in effect look at whether there's an increase in the margin charged and whether that has a cost justification. So if the retailer had charged, for instance, a 40% margin on ginger historically, and the price of ginger doubles and they retain that margin, then the price increase will be large. But there's very little we can do in terms of the regulations. That is something we've learned from this process, that sometimes very large cost increases result in very large absolute margin increases. And it's something we have noted. But I think the legally tractable rule is, and the common one globally, is around whether the margin increases or not. So that would explain why the price of ginger went up and why we would be limited in our ability to enforce against that.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, perhaps
trying to give a chief legal counsel by Kema Denge, but I see chairperson of the tribunal wanted to say something. Chairperson, do you want to clarify something?
It was just to add to what James has said about the prices of ginger. From the tribunal perspective, to say that some of the consent orders that we have confirmed that came from the commission were in respect of prices of ginger, where excessive pricing had definitely.
In this regard, I think Honorable Biane referenced, for instance, at dam ownership. And these questions, of course, of water ownership are heavily linked with questions of land ownership in South Africa. So one cannot really separate the two. So these issues are mainly regulatory issues, which are addressed in the National Water Act. And of course, what the National Water Act seeks to do is to try to ensure that water resources are under the custodianship of the state. So that regulatory framework in the National Water Act seeks to achieve that. So these issues have not really presented themselves within our context as full competition issues. But I think what is very much clear is that there are really regulatory issues to do with questions of ownership of what really is importantly a very scarce resource in our context. So it's an issue, of course, that, as I said, is addressed. And then the issues relating to sewer, of course, those are reticulation as well as, again, environmental issues, which are also addressed within the context of other regulatory framework, but not necessarily the competition framework. Thank you, TDG.
TDG Pule?
I think, Chair, we seem to have covered all the issues by my count here. So the last thing really, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, on behalf of the Director General, the Minister, on behalf of the Competition Commissioner, the Chairperson of the Tribunal, we'd like to thank the PC for this opportunity to bring them up to speed in terms of implementation of the Amendment Act. I have not noted anything at the moment that requires follow-up. I believe the issue around the eucalyptus was dealt with and will be finalized, and that seems to be sufficient. We note other comments, such as from Member Hermans around the penalties and others, which probably would be taken up at a later point. But on that note, Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity to present to the PC. Thank you.
Okay. Can I just say to the Portfolio Committee members that concludes the discussion, but obviously DDG, we do have regular updates on most of these important issues, like actually engaging today's meeting of the Competition Commission and the Tribunal. So because we have those going away and having the next session will mean we will actually update from what we engaged on here and be able to actually proceed. But if ever there's any specific issue that arises as a question that needs an answer, we generally would ask for 7 days to get an update. The one of the Eastern Cape, you might find, because there's still investigations, that you can be able to give an update to the committee of those kind of issues that, you know, you're still working on, giving a status after our meeting within 7 days, so that at least we have a closing status. When we actually have a follow-up meeting, we will actually then get an update moving forward. But knowing that is taken care of, it's quite crucial. So can I thank you, DDG, and the team, and maybe the portfolio committee members as well for the engagement. But further, I think we will be actually engaging at the next level of what progress is on the basis of today's discussion. So I'm sure we will actually conclude our session at that point. And maybe DDG, I'm not sure if ever you got a parting shot. If you want to, we can actually then allow you to do that. And on my part, I'll then move to the next part of our process in terms of closing of the meeting. DDG?
No parting shot, Chairperson.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Honorable members, Secretariat, I'm not sure if ever there'll be any issue you'd like to inform us on, but I think on our part, we will actually do have our portfolio committee meeting same time tomorrow on different issues. Can I get Secretariat just to confirm that? And I would like us to actually try and conclude our meeting at that point. Secretariat?
Okay, tomorrow we'll get an update on legislation with respect to the Protection of Investment Act and the Legal Metrology Act, Chair. The same process that we had today, Chair.
Well, to honourable members, the department and the commission can actually thank you, and for the committee, our meeting stand adjourned. Can we reconvene tomorrow at 9? Thank you very much. The meeting is...